so malevolent and powerful, he radiated his own gravitational field. Hazel knew they should leave. Their hiding place on top of the rock would be in plain sight to a creature that tall if he chose to look in their direction. But she sensed something important was about to happen. She and her friends crept a little farther down the schist and kept watching. As the giant got close, a cyclops woman broke ranks and ran back to speak with him. She was enormous, fat, and horribly ugly, wearing a chainmail dress like a muumuu, but next to the giant she looked like a child. She pointed to the closed-up convenience store on top of the nearest hill and muttered something about food. The giant snapped back an answer, as if he was annoyed. The female cyclops barked an order to her kindred, and three of them followed her up the hill. When they were halfway to the store, a searing light turned night into day. Hazel was blinded. Below her, the enemy army dissolved into chaos, monsters screaming in pain and outrage. Hazel squinted. She felt like she'd just stepped out of a dark theater into a sunny afternoon.
"Too pretty,"
the Cyclopes shrieked.
"Burns our eye."
The store on the hill was encased in a rainbow, closer and brighter than any Hazel had ever seen. The light was anchored at the store, shooting up into the heavens, bathing the countryside in a weird kaleidoscopic glow. The Lady Cyclops hefted her club and charged at the store. As she hit the rainbow, her whole body began to steam. She wailed in agony and dropped her club, retreating with multicolored blisters all over her arms and face.
"Horrible goddess," she bellowed at the store. "Give us snacks!"
The other monsters went crazy, charging the convenience store, then running away as the rainbow light burned them. Some threw rocks, spears, swords, and even pieces of their armor, all of which burned up in flames of pretty colors. Finally, the giant leader seemed to realize that his troops were throwing away perfectly good equipment.
"Stop!"
he roared. With some difficulty, he managed to shout and push and pummel his troops into submission. When they quieted down, he approached the rainbow-shielded store himself and stalked around the borders of the light.
"Goddess," he shouted, "come out and surrender."
No answer from the store. The rainbow continued to shimmer. The giant raised his trident and net.
"I am Polybetes. Kneel before me so I may destroy you quickly."
Apparently, no one in the store was impressed. A tiny dark object came sailing out the window and landed at the giant's feet. Polybetes yelled,
"Grenade!"
He covered his face. His troops hit the ground. When the thing did not explode, Polybetes bent down cautiously and picked it up. He roared in outrage.
"A ding-dong? You dare insult me with a ding-dong?"
He threw the cake back at the shop and it vaporized in the light. The monsters got to their feet. Several muttered hungrily,
"Ding-dongs? Where ding-dongs?"
"Let's attack," said the Lady Cyclops. "I am hungry. My boys want snacks."
"No," Polybetes said. "We're already late. Alcyoneus wants us at the camp in 4 days' time. You Cyclopes move inexcusably slowly. We have no time for minor goddesses."
He aimed that last comment at the store, but got no response. The Lady Cyclops growled,
"The camp, yes. Vengeance! The orange and purple ones destroyed my home. Now my gasket will destroy theirs. Do you hear me, Leo? Jason? Piper? I come to annihilate you."
The other Cyclopes bellowed in approval. The rest of the monsters joined in. Hazel's whole body tingled. She glanced at her friends.
"Jason," she whispered. "She fought Jason. He might still be alive."
Frank nodded.
"Do those other names mean anything to you?"
Hazel shook her head. She didn't know any Leo or Piper at camp. Percy still looked sickly and dazed. If the names meant anything to him, he didn't show it. Hazel pondered what the Cyclops had said. Orange and purple ones. Purple, obviously the color of Camp Jupiter, but orange. Percy had shown up in a tattered orange shirt. That couldn't be a coincidence. Below them, the army began to march south again, but the giant Polybetes stood to one side, frowning and sniffing the air.
"Sea God," he muttered.
To Hazel's horror, he turned in their direction.
"I smell Sea God."
Percy was shaking. Hazel put her hand on his shoulder and tried to press him flat against the rock. The Lady Cyclops Ma Gasket snarled.
"Of course you smell Sea God. The sea is right over there."
"More than that," Polybetes insisted. "I was born to destroy Neptune. I can sense."
He frowned, turning his head and shaking out a few more snakes.
"Do we march or sniff the air?"
Ma Gasket scolded.
"I don't get ding-dongs. You don't get Sea God."
Polybetes growled.
"Very well. March, march."
He took one last look at the rainbow-encased store, then raked his fingers through his hair. He brought out three snakes that seemed larger than the rest, with white markings around their necks.
"A gift, goddess. My name, Polybetes, means many to feed. Here are some hungry mouths for you. See if your store gets many customers with these sentries outside."
He laughed wickedly and threw the snakes into the tall grass on the hillside. Then he marched south, his massive Komodo legs shaking the earth. Gradually, the last column of monsters passed over the hills and disappeared into the night. Once they were gone, the blinding rainbow shut off like a spotlight. Hazel, Frank, and Percy were left alone in the dark, staring across the road at a closed-up convenience store.
"That was different," Frank muttered.
Percy shuddered violently. Hazel knew he needed help, or rest, or something. Seeing that army seemed to have triggered some kind of memory, leaving him shell-shocked. They should get him back to the boat. On the other hand, a huge stretch of grassland lay between them and the beach. Hazel got the feeling the carpoy wouldn't stay away forever. She didn't like the idea of the three of them making their way back to the boat in the middle of the night, and she couldn't shake the dreadful feeling that if she hadn't summoned that schist, she'd be a captive of the giant right now.
"Let's go to the store," she said. "If there's a goddess inside, maybe she can help us."
"Except a bunch of snake things are guarding the hill now," Frank said. "And that burning rainbow might come back."
They both looked at Percy, who was shaking like he had hypothermia.
"We've got to try," Hazel said.
Frank nodded grimly.
"Well, any goddess who throws a ding-dong at a giant can't be all bad. Let's go."
Chapter 21 Frank hated ding-dongs. He hated snakes. And he hated his life. Not necessarily in that order. As he trudged up the hill, he wished that he could pass out like Hazel. Just go into a trance and experience some other time, like before he got drafted for this insane quest, before he found out his dad was a godly drill sergeant with an ego problem. His bow and spear slapped against his back. He hated the spear, too. The moment he got it, he silently swore he'd never use it.
"A real man's weapon."
Mars was a moron. Maybe there had been a mix-up. Wasn't there some sort of DNA test for God's kids? Perhaps the godly nursery had accidentally switched Frank with one of Mars's buff little bully babies. No way would Frank's mother have gotten involved with that blustering war god.
"She was a natural warrior," Grandmother's voice argued. "It is no surprise that God would fall in love with her, given our family. Ancient blood, the blood of princes and heroes."
Frank shook the thought out of his head. He was no prince or hero. He was a lactose-intolerant klutz who couldn't even protect his friend from getting kidnapped by wheat. His new medals felt cold against his chest. The Centurion's Crescent, the mural crown. He should have been proud of them, but he felt like he'd only gotten them because his dad had bullied Raina. Frank didn't know how his friends could stand to be around him. Percy had made it clear that he hated Mars, and Frank couldn't blame him. Hazel kept watching Frank out of the corner of her eye, like she was afraid he might turn into a muscle-bound freak. Frank looked down at his body and sighed. Correction, even more of a muscle-bound freak. If Alaska really was a land beyond the gods, Frank might stay there. He wasn't sure he had anything to return to.
"Don't whine," his grandmother would say. "Jong men do not whine."
She was right. Frank had a job to do. He had to complete this impossible quest, which at the moment meant reaching the convenience store alive. As they got closer, Frank worried that the store might burst into rainbow light and vaporize them, but the building stayed dark. The snakes Polybetes had dropped seemed to have vanished. They were 20 yards from the porch when something hissed in the grass behind them.
"Go!"
Frank yelled. Percy stumbled. While Hazel helped him up, Frank turned and knocked an arrow. He shot blindly. He thought he'd grabbed an exploding arrow, but it was only a signal flare. It skidded through the grass, bursting into orange flame and whistling, "Woo!" At least it illuminated the monster. Sitting in a patch of withered yellow grass was a lime-colored snake as short and thick as Frank's arm. Its head was ringed with a mane of spiky white fins. The creature stared at the arrow zipping by as if wondering, "What the heck is that?" Then it fixed its large yellow eyes on Frank. It advanced like an inchworm, hunching up in the middle. Wherever it touched, the grass withered and died. Frank heard his friends climbing the steps of the store. He didn't dare turn and run. He and the snake studied each other. The snake hissed, flames billowing from its mouth.
"Nice, creepy reptile," Frank said, very aware of the driftwood in his coat pocket. "Nice, poisonous, fire-breathing reptile."
"Frank!" Hazel yelled behind him. "Come on!"
The snake sprang at him. It sailed through the air so fast there wasn't time to knock an arrow. Frank swung his bow and smacked the monster down the hill. It spun out of sight, wailing, "Scree!" Frank felt proud of himself until he looked at his bow, which was steaming where it had touched the snake. He watched in disbelief as the wood crumbled to dust. He heard an outraged hiss, answered by two more hisses farther downhill. Frank dropped his disintegrating bow and ran for the porch. Percy and Hazel pulled him up the steps. When Frank turned, he saw all three monsters circling in the grass, breathing fire and turning the hillside brown with their poisonous touch. They didn't seem able or willing to come closer to the store, but that wasn't much comfort to Frank. He'd lost his bow.
"We'll never get out of here," he said miserably.
"Then we'd better go in."
Hazel pointed to the hand-painted sign over the door. Rainbow Organic Foods and Lifestyles. Frank had no idea what that meant, but it sounded better than flaming poisonous snakes. He followed his friends inside. As they stepped through the door, lights came on. Flute music started up like they'd walked onto a stage. The wide aisles were lined with bins of nuts and dried fruit, baskets of apples, and clothing racks with tie-dyed shirts and gauzy Tinkerbell-type dresses. The ceiling was covered in wind chimes. Along the walls, glass cases displayed crystal balls, geodes, macrame dream catchers, and a bunch of other strange stuff. Incense must have been burning somewhere. It smelled like a bouquet of flowers was on fire.
"Fortune teller shop?" Frank wondered.
"Hope not," Hazel muttered.
Percy leaned against her. He looked worse than ever, like he'd been hit with a sudden flu. His face glistened with sweat.
"Sit down," he muttered. "Maybe water."
"Yeah," Frank said. "Let's find you a place to rest."
The floorboards creaked under their feet. Frank navigated between two Neptune statue fountains. A girl popped up from behind the granola bins.
"Help you?"
Frank lurched backward, knocking over one of the fountains. A stone Neptune crashed to the floor. The sea god's head rolled off and water spewed out of his neck, spraying a rack of tie-dyed man satchels.
"Sorry."
Frank bent down to clean up the mess. He almost goosed the girl with his spear.
"Eee!" she said. "Hold it. It's okay."
Frank straightened slowly, trying not to cause any more damage. Hazel looked mortified. Percy turned a sickly shade of green as he stared at the decapitated statue of his dad. The girl clapped her hands. The fountain dissolved into mist. The water evaporated. She turned to Frank.
"Really, it's no problem. Those Neptune fountains are so grumpy-looking. They bum me out."
She reminded Frank of the college-age hikers he sometimes saw in Lynn Canyon Park behind his grandmother's house. She was short and muscular, with lace-up boots, cargo shorts, and a bright yellow T-shirt that read ROFL, Rainbow Organic Foods and Lifestyles. She looked young, but her hair was frizzy white, sticking out on either side of her head like the white of a giant fried egg. Frank tried to remember how to speak. The girl's eyes were really distracting. The irises changed color from gray to black to white.
Sorry about the fountain, he managed. We were just...
Oh, I know, the girl said. You want to browse. It's all right. Demigods are welcome. Take your time. You're not like those awful monsters. They just want to use the restroom and never buy anything.
She snorted. Her eyes flashed with lightning. Frank glanced at Hazel to see if he'd imagined it, but Hazel looked just as surprised. From the back of the store, a woman's voice called.
Fleecy! Don't scare the customers now. Bring them here, will you?
Your name is Fleecy?
Hazel asked. Fleecy giggled.
Well, in the language of the nebulae, it's actually...
She made a series of crackling and blowing noises that reminded Frank of a thunderstorm giving way to a nice cold front.
But you can call me Fleecy.
Nebulae, Percy muttered in a daze. Cloud nymphs.
Fleecy beamed.
Oh, I like this one. Usually no one knows about cloud nymphs. But dear me, he doesn't look so good. Come to the back. My boss wants to meet you. We'll get your friend fixed up.
Fleecy led them through the produce aisle, between rows of eggplants, kiwis, lotus fruit, and pomegranates. At the back of the store, behind a counter with an old-fashioned cash register, stood a middle-aged woman with olive skin, long black hair, rimless glasses, and a T-shirt that read, "The Goddess is Alive." She wore amber necklaces and turquoise rings. She smelled like rose petals. She looked friendly enough, but something about her made Frank feel shaky, like he wanted to cry. It took him a second, then he realized what it was. The way she smiled with just one corner of her mouth, the warm brown color of her eyes, the tilt of her head, like she was considering a question. She reminded Frank of his mother.
Hello!
She leaned over the counter, which was lined with dozens of little statues, waving Chinese cats, meditating Buddhas, St. Francis bobbleheads, and novelty dippy-drinking birds with top hats.
So glad you're here. I'm Iris.
Hazel's eyes widened.
Not the Iris, the rainbow goddess?
Iris made a face.
Well, that's my official job, yes. But I don't define myself by my corporate identity. In my spare time, I run this.
She gestured around her proudly.
The Ruffle Co-op, an employee-run cooperative promoting healthy alternative lifestyles and organic foods.
Frank stared at her.
But you throw ding-dongs at monsters.
Iris looked horrified.
Oh, they're not ding-dongs.
She rummaged under the counter and brought out a package of chocolate-covered cakes that looked exactly like ding-dongs.
These are gluten-free, no sugar added, vitamin-enriched, soy-free, goat milk and seaweed-based cupcake simulations.
All natural, Fleecy chimed in.
I stand corrected.
Frank suddenly felt as queasy as Percy. Iris smiled.
You should try one, Frank. You're lactose intolerant, aren't you?
How did you...
I know these things, being the messenger goddess. Well, I do learn a lot. Hearing all the communications from the gods and so on.
She tossed the cakes on the counter.
Besides, those monsters should be glad to have some healthy snacks. Always eating junk food and heroes. They're so unenlightened. I couldn't have them tromping through my store, tearing up things and disturbing our feng shui.
Percy leaned against the counter. He looked like he was going to throw up all over the goddess's feng shui.
"Monsters marching south," he said with difficulty. "Going to destroy our camp. Couldn't you stop them?"
"Oh, I'm strictly non-violent," Iris said. "I can act in self-defense, but I won't be drawn into any more Olympian aggression, thank you very much. I've been reading about Buddhism and Taoism. I haven't decided between them."
"But," Hazel looked mystified, "aren't you a Greek goddess?"
Iris crossed her arms. "Don't try to put me in a box, demigod. I'm not defined by my past."
Okay, Hazel said. "Could you at least help our friend here? I think he's sick."
Percy reached across the counter. For a second, Frank was afraid he wanted the cupcakes.
"Iris, message," he said. "Can you send one?"
Frank wasn't sure he'd heard right.
"Iris, message?"
"It's..." Percy faltered. "Isn't that something you do?"
Iris studied Percy more closely.
"Interesting. You're from Camp Jupiter, and yet..."
"Oh, I see. Juno is up to her tricks."
"What?"
Hazel asked. Iris glanced at her assistant, Fleecy. They seemed to have a silent conversation. Then the goddess pulled a vial from behind the counter and sprayed some honeysuckle-smelling oil around Percy's face.
"There, that should balance your chakra. As for Iris messages, that's an ancient way of communication. The Greeks used it. The Romans never took to it, always relying on their road systems and giant eagles and whatnot. But yes, I imagine... Fleecy, could you give it a try?"
"Sure, boss."
Iris winked at Frank.
"Don't tell the other gods, but Fleecy handles most of my messages these days. She's wonderful at it, really, and I don't have time to answer all those requests personally. It messes up my wah."
"Your wah?" Frank asked.
Fleecy, why don't you take Percy and Hazel into the back? You can get them something to eat while you arrange their messages. And for Percy, yes, memory sickness. I imagine that old Polybetes. Well, meeting him in a state of amnesia can't be good for a child of that is to say, Neptune. Fleecy, give him a cup of green tea with organic honey and wheat germ and some of my medicinal powder number 5. That should fix him up."
Hazel frowned.
"What about Frank?"
Iris turned to him. She tilted her head quizzically, just the way his mother used to, as if Frank were the biggest question in the room.
"Oh, don't worry," Iris said. "Frank and I have a lot to talk about."
Chapter 22 Frank. Frank would have preferred to go with his friends, even if it meant he had to endure green tea with wheat germ. But Iris roped her arm through his and led him to a cafe table at a bay window. Frank set his spear on the floor. He sat across from Iris. Outside in the dark, the snake monsters restlessly patrolled the hillside, spewing fire and poisoning the grass.
"Frank, I know how you feel," Iris said. "I imagine that half-burned stick in your pocket gets heavier every day."
Frank couldn't breathe. His hand went instinctively to his coat.
"How do you..."
"I told you, I know things. I was Juno's messenger for ages. I know why she gave you a reprieve."
"A reprieve?"
Frank brought out the piece of firewood and unwrapped it from its cloth. As unwieldy as Mars's spear was, the piece of tinder was worse. Iris was right. It weighed him down.
"Juno saved you for a reason," the goddess said. "She wants you to serve her plan. If she hadn't appeared that day when you were a baby and warned your mother about the firewood, you would have died. You were born with too many gifts. That sort of power tends to burn out a mortal life."
"Too many gifts?"
Frank felt his ears getting warm with anger.
"I don't have any gifts."
"That's not true, Frank." Iris swiped her hand in front of her like she was cleaning a windshield. A miniature rainbow appeared.
"Think about it."
An image shimmered in the rainbow. Frank saw himself when he was 4 years old running across grandmother's backyard. His mother leaned out the window of the attic high above, waving and calling to get his attention. Frank wasn't supposed to be in the backyard by himself. He didn't know why his mother was up in the attic, but she told him to stay by the house, not to go too far. Frank did exactly the opposite. He squealed with delight and ran to the edge of the woods, where he came face to face with a grizzly bear. Until Frank saw that scene in the rainbow, the memory had been so hazy, he thought he'd dreamed it. Now he could appreciate just how surreal the experience had been. The bear regarded the little boy, and it was difficult to tell who was more startled. Then Frank's mother appeared at his side. There was no way she should have been able to get down from the attic so fast. She put herself between the bear and Frank and told him to run to the house. This time, Frank obeyed. When he turned at the back porch, he saw his mother coming out of the woods. The bear was gone. Frank asked what had happened. His mother smiled. "Mama Bear just needed directions," she said. The scene in the rainbow changed. Frank saw himself as a 6-year-old, curling up in his mother's lap even though he was much too big for that. His mother's long black hair was pulled back. Her arms were around him. She wore her rimless glasses that Frank always liked to steal, and her fuzzy gray fleece pullover that smelled like cinnamon. She was telling him stories about heroes, pretending they were all related to Frank. One was Tzu Fu, who sailed in search of the elixir of life. The rainbow image had no sound, but Frank remembered his mother's words. "He was your great, great, great." She would poke Frank's stomach every time she said great, dozens of times, until he was giggling uncontrollably. Then there was Sun Gua, also called Seneca Gracchus, who fought 12 Roman dragons and 16 Chinese dragons in the western deserts of China. "He was the strongest dragon of all, you see," his mother said. "That's how he could beat them." Frank didn't know what that meant, but it sounded exciting. Then she poked his belly with so many grates, Frank rolled onto the floor to escape the tickling. "And your very oldest ancestor that we know of, he was the Prince of Pylos. Hercules fought him once. It was a hard fight." "Did we win?" Frank asked. His mother laughed, but there was sadness in her voice. "No, our ancestor lost. But it wasn't easy for Hercules. Imagine trying to fight a swarm of bees. That's how it was. Even Hercules had trouble." The comment made no sense to Frank, then or now. His ancestor had been a beekeeper? Frank hadn't thought about these stories in years, but now they came back to him as clearly as his mother's face. It hurt to see her again. Frank wanted to go back to that time. He wanted to be a little kid and curl up on her lap. In the rainbow image, little Frank asked where their family was from. So many heroes. Were they from Pylos, or Rome, or China, or Canada? His mother smiled, tilting her head as if considering how to answer. "Li Jian," she said at last. "Our family is from many places, but our home is Li Jian. Always remember, Frank, you have a special gift. You can be anything." The rainbow dissolved, leaving just Iris and Frank.
"I don't understand." His voice was hoarse.
"Your mother explained it," Iris said. "You can be anything." It sounded like one of those stupid things parents say to boost your self-esteem, a worn-out slogan that could be printed on Iris's T-shirts, right along with "The Goddess is Alive" and "My Other Car is a Magic Carpet." But the way Iris said it, it sounded like a challenge. Frank pressed his hand against his pants pocket, where he kept his mother's sacrifice medal. The silver medallion was cold as ice.
"I can't be anything," Frank insisted. "I've got zero skills."
"What have you tried?" Iris asked. "You wanted to be an archer. You managed that pretty well." "You've only scratched the surface. Your friends Hazel and Percy, they're both stretched between worlds, Greek and Roman, the past and the present. But you are stretched more than either of them. Your family is ancient, the blood of Pylos on your mother's side, and your father is Mars. No wonder Juno wants you to be one of her 7 heroes. She wants you to fight the giants and Gia. But think about this. What do you want?
I don't have any choice, Frank said. I'm the son of the stupid war god. I have to go on this quest and...
Have to? Ira said. Not want to. I used to think like that. Then I got tired of being everyone's servant. Fetch goblets of wine for Jupiter. Deliver letters for Juno. Send messages back and forth across the rainbow for anyone with a golden drachma.
A golden what?
Not important. But I learned to let go. I started Raffle, and now I'm free of that baggage. You can let go, too. Maybe you can't escape fate. Someday that piece of wood will burn. I foresee that you'll be holding it when it happens, and your life will end.
Thanks, Frank muttered.
But that just makes your life more precious. You don't have to be what your parents and your grandmother expect. You don't have to follow the war god's orders or Juno's. Do your own thing, Frank. Find a new path. Frank thought about that. The idea was thrilling. Reject the gods, his destiny, his dad. He didn't want to be a war god's son. His mother had died in a war. Frank had lost everything thanks to a war. Mars clearly didn't know the first thing about him. Frank didn't want to be a hero.
Why are you telling me this? He asked. You want me to abandon the quest? Let Camp Jupiter be destroyed? My friends are counting on me.
Iris spread her hands. I can't tell you what to do, Frank. But do what you want, not what they tell you to do. Where did conforming ever get me? I spent 5 millennia serving everyone else, and I never discovered my own identity. What's my sacred animal? No one bothered to give me one. Where are my temples? They never made any. Well, fine. I found peace here at the co-op. You could stay with us if you want. Become a rufflecopter.
A what now?
The point is you have options. If you continue this quest, what happens when you free Thanatos? Will it be good for your family? Your friends?
Frank remembered what his grandmother had said. She had an appointment with death. Grandmother infuriated him sometimes, but still, she was his only living family, the only person alive who loved him. If Thanatos stayed chained up, Frank might not lose her. And Hazel. Somehow she had come back from the underworld. If death took her again, Frank wouldn't be able to stand it. Not to mention Frank's own problem. According to Iris, he should have died when he was a baby. All that stood between him and death was a half-burned stick. Would Thanatos take him away too? Frank tried to imagine staying here with Iris, putting on a raffle shirt, selling crystals and dream catchers to demigod travelers, and lobbing gluten-free cupcake simulations at passing monsters. Meanwhile, an undying army would overrun Camp Jupiter.
You can be anything, his mother had said.
No, he thought. I can't be that selfish. I have to go, he said. It's my job.
Iris sighed. I expected as much, but I had to try. The task ahead of you, well, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, especially a nice boy like you. If you must go, at least I can offer some advice. You'll need help finding Thanatos.
You know where the giants are hiding him? Frank asked.
Iris gazed thoughtfully at the wind chime swaying on the ceiling. No. Alaska is beyond the god's sphere of control. The location is shielded from my sight. But there is someone who would know. Seek out the seer, Phineas. He's blind, but he can see the past, present, and future. He knows many things. He can tell you where Thanatos is being held.
Phineas, Frank said. Wasn't there a story about him?
Iris nodded reluctantly. In the old days, he committed horrible crimes. He used his gift of sight for evil. Jupiter sent the harpies to plague him. The Argonauts, including your ancestor, by the way.
The Prince of Pelos?
Iris hesitated. Yes, Frank. Though his gift, his story, that you must discover on your own. Suffice it to say, the Argonauts drove away the Harpies in exchange for Phineas's help.
That was eons ago, but I understand Phineas has returned to the mortal world. You'll find him in Portland, Oregon, which is on your way north. But you must promise me one thing. If he's still plagued by Harpies, do not kill them.
No matter what, Phineas promises you.
Win his help some other way. The Harpies are not evil. They're my sisters.
Your sisters?
I know, I don't look old enough to be the Harpy's sister, but it's true.
And Frank, there's another problem. If you're determined to leave, you'll have to clear those basilisks off the hill.
You mean the snakes?
Yes, Ira said. Basilisk means little crown, which is a cute name for something that's not very cute. I prefer not to have them killed. They're living creatures, after all. But you won't be able to leave until they're gone. If your friends try to battle them, well, I foresee bad things happening. Only you have the ability to kill the monsters.
But how?
She glanced down at the floor. Frank realized that she was looking at his spear.
I wish there was another way, she said. If you had some weasels, for instance.
Weasels are deadly to basilisks.
Fresh out of weasels, Frank admitted.
Then you will have to use your father's gift. Are you sure you wouldn't like to live here instead? We make excellent lactose-free rice milk.
Frank rose.
How do I use the spear?
You'll have to handle that on your own. I can't advocate violence. While you're doing battle, I'll check on your friends. I hope Fleasy found the right medicinal herbs. The last time we had a mix-up, well, I don't think those heroes wanted to be daisies.
The goddess stood. Her glasses flashed, and Frank saw his own reflection in the lenses. He looked serious and grim. Nothing like the little boy he'd seen in those rainbow images.
One last bit of advice, Frank, she said.
You're destined to die holding that piece of firewood, watching it burn. But, perhaps, if you didn't keep it yourself, perhaps if you trusted someone enough to hold it for you.
Frank's fingers curled around the tinder. Are you offering?
Iris laughed gently. Oh, dear, no. I'd lose it in this collection.
It would get mixed up with my crystals, or I'd sell it as a driftwood paperweight by accident. No, I meant a demigod friend, someone close to your heart.
Hazel, Frank thought immediately. There was no one he trusted more. But how could he confess his secret? If he admitted how weak he was, that his whole life depended on a half-burned stick, Hazel would never see him as a hero. He'd never be her knight in armor. And how could he expect her to take that kind of burden from him?
He wrapped up the tinder and slipped it back into his coat. Thanks. Thanks, Iris.
She squeezed his hand.
Don't lose hope, Frank. Rainbows always stand for hope.
She made her way toward the back of the store, leaving Frank alone.
Hope, Frank grumbled. I'd rather have a few good weasels.
He picked up his father's spear and marched out to face the basilisks. Chapter 23 Frank. Frank missed his bow. He wanted to stand on the porch and shoot the snakes from a distance. A few well-placed exploding arrows, a few craters in the hillside. Problem solved. Unfortunately, a quiver full of arrows wouldn't do Frank much good if he couldn't shoot them. Besides, he had no idea where the basilisks were. They'd stopped blowing fire as soon as he came outside. He stepped off the porch and leveled his golden spear. He didn't like fighting up close. He was too slow and bulky. He'd done okay during the war games, but this was real. There were no giant eagles ready to snatch him up and take him to the medics if he made a mistake.
You can be anything, his mother's voice echoed in his mind.
Great, he thought. I want to be good with a spear, and immune to poison and fire. Something told Frank his wish had not been granted. The spear felt just as awkward in his hands. Patches of flame still smoldered on the hillside. The acrid smoke burned in Frank's nose. The withered grass crunched under his feet. He thought about those stories his mother used to tell. Generations of heroes who had battled Hercules, fought dragons, and sailed monster-infested seas. Frank didn't understand how he could have evolved from a line like that, or how his family had migrated from Greece through the Roman Empire all the way to China. But some unsettling ideas were starting to form. For the first time, he started to wonder about this Prince of Pelos and his great-grandfather Shen Lun's disgrace at Camp Jupiter, and what the family powers might be.
"The gift has never kept our family safe," Grandmother had warned.
A reassuring thought as Frank hunted poisonous, fire-breathing devil snakes. The night was quiet, except for the crackle of brush fires. Every time a breeze made the grass rustle, Frank thought about the grain spirits who'd captured Hazel. Hopefully they'd gone south with the giant Polybetes. Frank didn't need any more problems right now. He crept downhill, his eyes stinging from the smoke. Then, about 20 feet ahead, he saw a burst of flame. He considered throwing his spear. Stupid idea. Then he'd be without a weapon. Instead, he advanced toward the fire. He wished he had the Gorgon's blood vials, but they were back at the boat. He wondered if Gorgon blood could cure basilisk poison. But even if he had the vials and managed to choose the right one, he doubted he'd have time to take it before he crumbled to dust like his bow. He emerged in a clearing of burned grass and found himself face to face with a basilisk. The snake rose up on its tail. It hissed and expanded the collar of white spikes around its neck. "Little crown," Frank remembered. That's what basilisk meant. He had thought basilisks were huge dragon-like monsters that could petrify you with their eyes. Somehow the real basilisk was even more terrible. As tiny as it was, this extra-small package of fire, poison, and evil would be much harder to kill than a large, bulky lizard. Frank had seen how fast it could move. The monster fixed its pale yellow eyes on Frank. Why wasn't it attacking? Frank's golden spear fell cold and heavy. The dragon tooth point dipped toward the ground all on its own, like a dousing rod, searching for water. Stop that. Frank struggled to lift the spear. He'd have enough trouble jabbing the monster without his spear fighting against him. Then he heard the grass rustle on either side of him. The other two basilisks slithered into the clearing. Frank had walked straight into an ambush. Chapter 24 Frank. Frank swept his spear back and forth.
Stay back! His voice sounded squeaky. I've got, amazing powers and stuff.
The basilisks hissed in three-part harmony. Maybe they were laughing. The spear tip was almost too heavy to lift now, as if the jagged white triangle of bone was trying to touch the earth. Then something clicked in the back of Frank's mind. Mars had said the tip was a dragon's tooth. Hadn't there been some story about dragon's teeth planted in the ground? Something he'd read in monster class at camp? The basilisks circled him, taking their time. Maybe they were hesitating because of the spear. Maybe they just couldn't believe how stupid Frank was. It seemed like madness, but Frank let the spear tip drop. He drove it into the ground. Crack! When he lifted it out, the tip was gone, broken off in the dirt. Wonderful. Now he had a golden stick. Some crazy part of him wanted to bring out his piece of firewood. If he was going to die anyway, maybe he could set off a massive blaze, incinerate the basilisks, so at least his friends could get away. Before he could get up the courage, the ground rumbled at his feet. Dirt spewed everywhere, and a skeletal hand clawed the air. The basilisks hissed and backed up. Frank couldn't blame them. He watched in horror as a human skeleton crawled out of the ground. It took on flesh as if someone were pouring gelatin over its bones, covering them in glowing, transparent gray skin. Then ghostly clothes enveloped it, a muscle shirt, camo pants, and army boots. Everything about the creature was gray, gray clothes on gray flesh on gray bones. It turned toward Frank. Its skull grinned beneath an expressionless gray face. Frank whimpered like a puppy. His legs shook so badly he had to support himself with the spear shaft. The skeleton warrior was waiting, Frank realized, waiting for orders.
"Kill the basilisks,"
he yelled.
"Not me."
The skeletal warrior leaped into action. He grabbed the nearest snake, and though his gray flesh began to smoke on contact, he strangled the basilisk with one hand and flung down its limp body. The other two basilisks hissed with rage. One sprang at Frank, but he knocked it aside with the butt of his spear. The other snake belched fire directly in the skeleton's face. The warrior marched forward and stomped the basilisk's head under his boot. Frank turned toward the last basilisk, which was curled at the edge of the clearing studying them. Frank's imperial gold spear shaft was steaming, but unlike his bow, it didn't seem to be crumbling from the basilisk's touch. The skeleton warrior's right foot and hand were slowly dissolving from poison. His head was on fire, but otherwise he looked pretty good. The basilisk did the smart thing. It turned to flee. In a blur of motion, the skeleton pulled something from his shirt and flung it across the clearing, impaling the basilisk in the dirt. Frank thought it was a knife. Then he realized it was one of the skeleton's own ribs. Frank was glad his stomach was empty.
That was gross.
The skeleton stumbled over to the basilisk. It pulled out its rib and used it to cut off the creature's head. The basilisk dissolved into ashes. Then the skeleton decapitated the other two monster carcasses and kicked all the ashes to disperse them. Frank remembered the two gorgons in the Tiber, the way the river had pulled apart their remains to keep them from reforming.
"You're making sure they don't come back," Frank realized.
"Or slowing them down, anyway." The skeleton warrior stood at attention in front of Frank. Its poisoned foot and hand were mostly gone. Its head was still burning.
What are you?" Frank asked.
He wanted to add, "Please don't hurt me." The skeleton saluted with its stump of a hand. Then it began to crumble, sinking back into the ground.
"Wait," Frank said. "I don't even know what to call you. Toothman? Bones? Gray?"
As its face disappeared beneath the dirt, the warrior seemed to grin at the last name. Or maybe that was just its skeletal teeth showing. Then it was gone, leaving Frank alone with his pointless spear.
"Gray," he muttered. "Okay. But..."
He examined the tip of his spear. Already, a new dragon tooth was starting to grow out of the golden shaft.
"You get 3 charges out of it," Mars had said. "So use it wisely."
Frank heard footsteps behind him. Percy and Hazel ran into the clearing. Percy looked better, except he was carrying a tie-dyed man satchel from Raffle. Definitely not his style. Riptide was in his hand. Hazel had drawn her spatha.
"Are you okay?"
she asked. Percy turned in a circle looking for enemies.
"Iris told us you were out here battling the basilisks by yourself. And we were like, what? We came as fast as we could. What happened?"
"I'm not sure," Frank admitted. Hazel crouched next to the dirt where Gray disappeared.
"I sense death. Either my brother has been here or... the basilisks are dead?"
Percy stared at him in awe.
"You killed them all?"
Frank swallowed. He already felt like enough of a misfit without trying to explain his new undead minion. 3 charges. Frank could call on Gray twice more. But he'd sensed malevolence in the skeleton. It was no pet. It was a vicious, undead killing force, barely controlled by the power of Mars. Frank got the feeling it would do what he said. But if his friends happened to be in the line of fire, oh well. And if Frank was a little slow giving it directions, it might start killing whatever was in its path, including its master. Mars had told him the spear would give him breathing room until he learned to use his mother's talents, which meant Frank needed to learn those talents fast.
"Thanks a lot, Dad," he grumbled.
"What?" Hazel asked. "Frank, are you okay?"
"I'll explain later," he said. "Right now, there's a blind man in Portland we've got to see."
Chapter 25. Percy. Percy already felt like the lamest demigod in the history of lame. The purse was the final insult. They'd left Raffle in a hurry, so maybe Iris hadn't meant the bag as a criticism. She'd quickly stuffed it with vitamin-enriched pastries, dried fruit leather, macrobiotic beef jerky, and a few crystals for good luck. Then she'd shoved it at Percy. Here, you'll need this. Oh, that looks good. The purse, sorry, masculine accessory bag, was rainbow tie-dyed with a peace symbol stitched in wooden beads and the slogan, "Hug the whole world." Percy wished it said, "Hug the commode." He felt like the bag was a comment on his massive, incredible uselessness. As they sailed north, he put the man satchel as far away from him as he could, but the boat was small. He couldn't believe how he'd broken down when his friends had needed him. First, he'd been dumb enough to leave them alone when he had run back to the boat, and Hazel had gotten kidnapped. Then he'd watched that army marching south and had some kind of nervous breakdown. Embarrassing? Yeah. But he couldn't help it. When he'd seen those evil centaurs and cyclopes, it had seemed so wrong, so backward, that he thought his head would explode. And the giant, Polybetes. That giant had given him a feeling the opposite of what he felt when he stood in the ocean. Percy's energy had drained out of him, leaving him weak and feverish, like his insides were eroding. Iris's medicinal tea had helped his body feel better, but his mind still hurt. He'd heard stories about amputees who had phantom pains where their missing legs and arms used to be. That's how his mind felt, like his missing memories were aching. Worst of all, the farther north Percy went, the more those memories faded. He had started to feel better at Camp Jupiter, remembering random names and faces, but now even Annabeth's face was getting dimmer. At Raffle, when he'd tried to send an Iris message to Annabeth, Fleecy had just shaken her head sadly.
"It's like you're dialing somebody," she said, "but you've forgotten the number. Or someone is jamming the signal. Sorry, dear, I just can't connect you."
He was terrified that he'd lose Annabeth's face completely when he got to Alaska. Maybe he'd wake up one day and not remember her name. Still, he had to concentrate on the quest. The sight of that enemy army had shown him what they were up against. It was early in the morning of June 21st, now. They had to get to Alaska, find Thanatos, locate the Legion's standard, and make it back to Camp Jupiter by the evening of June 24th. 4 days. Meanwhile, the enemy had only a few hundred miles to march. Percy guided the boat through the strong currents off the northern California coast. The wind was cold, but it felt good, clearing some of the confusion from his head. He bent his will to push the boat as hard as he could. The hull rattled as the packs plowed its way north. Meanwhile, Hazel and Frank traded stories about the events at Rainbow Organic Foods. Frank explained about the blind seer Phineas in Portland, and how Iris had said that he might be able to tell them where to find Thanatos. Frank wouldn't say how he had managed to kill the basilisks, but Percy got the feeling it had something to do with the broken point of his spear. Whatever had happened, Frank sounded more scared of the spear than the basilisks. When he was done, Hazel told Frank about their time with Fleecy.
"So this Iris message worked?" Frank asked.
Hazel gave Percy a sympathetic look. She didn't mention his failure to contact Annabeth.
"I got in touch with Raina," she said. "You're supposed to throw a coin into a rainbow and say this incantation like, 'O Iris, goddess of the rainbow, accept my offering.' Except Fleecy kind of changed it. She gave us her, what did she call it? Her direct number? So I had to say, 'Oh, Fleecy, do me a solid. Show Raina at Camp Jupiter.' I felt kind of stupid, but it worked. Raina's image appeared in the rainbow, like a two-way video call. She was in the baths. Scared her out of her mind."
"That I would have paid to see," Frank said. "I mean, her expression. Not, you know, the baths."
"Frank!"
Hazel fanned her face like she needed air. It was an old-fashioned gesture, but cute somehow.
"Anyway, we told Raina about the army, but like Percy said, she pretty much already knew. It doesn't change anything. She's doing what she can to shore up the defenses. Unless we unleash death and get back with the eagle..."
"The camp can't stand against that army," Frank finished. "Not without help."
After that, they sailed in silence.
Percy kept thinking about Cyclopes and centaurs. He thought about Annabeth, the satyr Grover, and his dream of a giant warship under construction. "You came from somewhere," Raina had said. Percy wished he could remember. He could call for help. Camp Jupiter shouldn't have to fight alone against the giants. There must be allies out there. He fingered the beads on his necklace, the lead probatio tablet, and the silver ring Raina had given him. Maybe in Seattle he'd be able to talk to her sister, Hilla. She might send help, assuming she didn't kill Percy on sight. After a few more hours of navigating, Percy's eyes started to droop. He was afraid he'd pass out from exhaustion. Then he caught a break. A killer whale surfaced next to the boat, and Percy struck up a mental conversation with him. It wasn't exactly like talking, but it went something like this. "Could you give us a ride north?" Percy asked. "Like as close to Portland as possible?"
"Eat seals," the whale responded. "Are you seals?"
"No," Percy admitted. "I've got a man satchel full of macrobiotic beef jerky, though." The whale shuddered.
"Promise not to feed me this, and I will take you north."
"Deal." Soon Percy had made a makeshift rope harness and strapped it around the whale's upper body. They sped north under whale power, and at Hazel and Frank's insistence, Percy settled in for a nap. His dreams were as disjointed and scary as ever. He imagined himself on Mount Tamalpais, north of San Francisco, fighting at the old Titan stronghold. That didn't make sense. He hadn't been with the Romans when they had attacked, but he saw it all clearly. A Titan in armor, Annabeth and two other girls fighting at Percy's side. One of the girls died in the battle. Percy knelt over her, watching as she dissolved into stars. Then he saw the giant warship in its dry dock. The bronze dragon figurehead glinted in the morning light. The riggings and armaments were complete, but something was wrong. A hatch in the deck was open, and smoke poured from some kind of engine. A boy with curly black hair was cursing as he pounded the engine with a wrench. Two other demigods squatted next to him, watching with concern. One was a teenage guy with short blonde hair. The other was a girl with long dark hair. "You realize it's the solstice," the girl said. "We're supposed to leave today."
"I know that,"
the curly-haired mechanic whacked the engine a few more times.
"Could be the fizz rockets. Could be the Samoflange. Could be Gia messing with us again. I'm not sure."
"How long?" the blonde guy asked.
2-3 days.
"They may not have that long," the girl warned. Something told Percy that she meant Camp Jupiter. Then the scene shifted again. He saw a boy and his dog roaming over the yellow hills of California. But as the image became clearer, Percy realized it wasn't a boy. It was a cyclops in ragged jeans and a flannel shirt. The dog was a shambling mountain of black fur, easily as big as a rhino. The cyclops carried a massive club over his shoulder, but Percy didn't feel that he was an enemy. He kept yelling Percy's name, calling him brother.
"He smells farther away," the cyclops moaned to the dog. "Why does he smell farther?"
"Roof,"
the dog barked, and Percy's dream changed again. He saw a range of snowy mountains, so tall they broke the clouds. Gia's sleeping face appeared in the shadows of the rocks.
"Such a valuable pawn," she said soothingly. "Do not fear, Percy Jackson. Come north. Your friends will die, yes. But I will preserve you for now. I have great plans for you."
In a valley between the mountains lay a massive field of ice. The edge plunged into the sea hundreds of feet below, with sheets of frost constantly crumbling into the water. On top of the ice field stood a legion camp, ramparts, moats, towers, barracks, just like Camp Jupiter, except 3 times as large. At the crossroads outside the Principia, a figure in dark robes stood shackled to the ice. Percy's vision swept past him, into the headquarters. There, in the gloom, sat a giant even bigger than Polybetes. His skin glinted gold.
Displayed behind him were the tattered frozen banners of a Roman legion, including a large golden eagle with its wings spread.
"We await you,"
the giant's voice boomed.